This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. Hong Kong police and protesters clashed on Sunday as tens of thousands marched through the central city wearing face masks in defiance of a new ban on facial coverings. Police fired tear gas while some protesters threw bricks and Molotov cocktails at police. Pro-democracy lawmaker Dennis Kwok says Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, has taken away the democratic rights of the people.
Carrie Lam is saying that whatever I say is law, is law. Whenever I say it applies, it applies. Whenever I say it will be repealed, it will be repealed. The people has no say. The Legislative Council has no say.
For the last 4 months, the city has been engulfed in unrest as democracy advocates engaged in increasingly confrontational tactics to fight against what they see as China's effort to restrict Hong Kong's autonomy and civil liberties. A second whistleblower has spoken to the intelligence community's internal watchdog about U.S. President Donald Trump. AP's Ben Thomas has more.
A lawyer for the original whistleblower tells the Associated Press he's representing a second person who works in intelligence who has information that backs the original complaint. Mark Zaid says that second whistleblower hasn't filed a complaint with the inspector general yet, but has firsthand knowledge of the president's dealings with Ukraine. The original whistleblower complained that President Trump was using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the upcoming presidential election. Trump maintains he's done nothing improper. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Iraq's cabinet issued a new reform plan Sunday following a night of clashes in which security forces opened fire on protesters, killing at least 19 people. The cabinet met through the night in an effort to respond to 5 days of protests that have taken authorities by surprise and led to the deaths of nearly 100 people. From Washington, this is VOA News. North Korea says it won't meet with the United States for more negotiations unless it abandons its hostile policy against the North, as the two countries offered different takes on their weekend nuclear talks in Sweden. After their first talks in more than 7 months, on Saturday, the chief North Korean nuclear negotiator said the discussions broke down entirely because the U.S. has not discarded its old stance and attitude. But the U.S. said the two sides had good discussions that it intends to build on with more talks in 2 weeks. Portugal's Prime Minister António Costa looks set for victory in this country's election, though he will likely need the support of other parties. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Portugal's centre-left socialists are expected to hold on to power and win more seats in Parliament as voters head to the polls on Sunday. But the question is, who will help prop up Prime Minister António Costa's government? After 4 years of economic growth, opinion polls suggest the socialists will win the election with between 36.5% and 38.8% of the vote. That means Costa will have little option but to ask other parties for support. When he took power in 2015, Costa won the parliamentary support of two far-left Eurosceptic parties. 4 years on, and the love affair has waned, with the hard left demanding more public spending and accusing Costa of veering to the right.
That is Reuters' David Doyle reporting. Voters in Kosovo are electing a new parliament today amid calls for leaders to resume dialogue with Serbia over normalizing ties. Some 1.9 million eligible voters started to cast their ballots to elect 120 lawmakers in the Balkan nation that became independent from Serbia in 2008. Police have blocked a march by thousands of people in Pakistani-controlled Kashmir who wanted to move toward the highly militarized line of control that divides the territory between Pakistan and India. The marchers are protesting the lockdown in Indian-administered Kashmir. Saudi Arabia has lifted some restrictions on women traveling in the ultra-conservative Muslim kingdom. AP's Karen Chamas reports.
The easing of strict rules on social interactions comes after Riyadh launched its first tourist visa scheme as part of efforts to open up the country to foreign visitors and diversify its oil-reliant economy. Authorities have said that women will be allowed to rent hotel rooms with proof of identity. The same would be required of foreign couples without the need for them to present a marriage certificate. The move comes amid deep reforms over the past year by Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, although critics note there are limits to the reforms and point to last year's killing of Saudi writer Jamal Khashoggi. I'm Karen Chamas.
And for all of the latest news, go to the VOA News website. And you can also download the mobile app for news on the go. In Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Very significant, not just for Tunisia, for the entire African continent, and also for the wider world, because it's here that the revolution started, and they have an expectation from the young people, and I think they have to come out and they have to do the due diligence and vote.
Tunisians vote for a new parliament Sunday.
You hope that Mr. Bia, at this stage, seeing the number of children that have died in the Anglophone, this thing, the economy that is broken down, which has affected all Cameroonians, you'll have that call of conscience to start implementing this so that from there we'll see the loopholes and continue pushing for more.
Cameroonian opposition leader expresses cautious optimism regarding the implementation of recommendations of the just-ended national dialogue.
What the president has done and what the Patriotic Front has been pushing for is that even on the most contentious pieces of legislation, such as the Public Order Act, such as the Penal Code, the question has been, let the members of parliament, let the legislature do what they're supposed to do, and that is to amend the law.
And Zambians continue with a review of the constitution despite opposition criticisms. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Tunisians vote to elect a new parliament Sunday. Today's poll is the country's third parliamentary election since 2011. Voters will choose from over 15,000 candidates from different parties, party coalition or independent candidates for the 217-seat parliament. Officials of the Independent High Authority for Elections say 7 million people are eligible to vote in Sunday's parliamentary vote. For more on the election, I reached the former president of Mauritius, Amina Fidaus Gurib Fakim, the head of the mission of the African Union Poll Observer Mission to monitor the Tunisian election.
Well, so far, just like last time, the turnout has been relatively low for the time being because we are still midday here. And we've seen, interestingly, more young people this time have come out as opposed to last time. Last time we saw mostly the elderly who had come out. But then again, we're still early days yet, early hours. So I presume after 3 o'clock, there will be an acceleration in terms of turnout. But judging by the turnout, again, I don't see a massive turnout, unfortunately.
Interacting with the Tunisian voters, what feedback did they give you about this parliamentary election?
Again, I think, unfortunately, because the parliamentary election is coming just before the second round of the presidential, a lot of attention has been focused on the presidential. And I don't think people have measured the importance of having voting for the government. So it has been kind of diluted. The impact has been diluted. But I hope that by virtue of the turnout, we will see a better representation of the will of the people here.
Talk to me about the transparency of the vote and how some of these political parties or independent candidates are helping to ensure the credibility of this parliamentary election today.
Well, already the election as we know it is kind of unique because we've got two major candidates and one of them is out and the other one is not available right now. He's in prison. So already this makes it a very interesting process. But in terms of transparency, we've seen free movement of the people. The ballot boxes are transparent. People are coming and voting. There is no intimidation, completely free. And just like last time, we saw a total transparency of the process. And I think here we have to congratulate EASY, the Electoral Commission, which has had a very, very short delay, but they still managed to bring people together and really maintain the credibility of the entire process.
What feedback have you heard from your long-term observers who have observed the process ahead of this parliamentary election and in anticipation of the second round of the presidential election?
We're just here observing, and everybody's feedback has been positive so far. So so far, but I think we are, as I said, we are still halfway through the day, so we'll have to wait till the evening to know exactly, you know, how the whole thing will go. But if we go by the last time, the first run of the presidential election, the process was fully appreciated. It was maintained correctly, and even at the level of the vote counting, we saw that it was done correctly. So from that level, at that point, we don't really have much to say in terms of the process. The procedure have been adhered to. The only thing which remains interesting is the fact that we have two candidates and one is still in prison.
Talk to me about how the Electoral Commission has organized the process so far with regards to the first round, this parliamentary, and the anticipated runoff of the presidential election.
Oh, they've done a good job. They have really done a good job by virtue of the short delay that they have been given to organize everything. And last time I met with them and we went through the process, because last time we had the two candidates and the situation then was different, because we were hoping that the candidate would be released by, you know, by some process. But unfortunately, the judges have not entertained the, you know, kind of freeing the guy to run his campaign. We were at that discussion last time. They are fully aware, they're fully apprised of, you know, the import of this situation. But I think they've tried to do a very, very credible process. They have maintained, they have respected all the provision of the law in running of that campaign, and I think it's all in their favor.
What are your expectations and your message to the people of Tunisia as they vote today?
I think the message is that everybody should come out and vote. This is, of course, very significant, not just for Tunisia, for the entire African continent, and also for the wider world, because it's here that the revolution started, and they have an expectation from the young people, and I think they have to come out, and they have to do the due diligence and vote, and they have to come out in massive numbers so that the election process at the end of this cycle would be really truly effective of the will of the people.
Amina Fidaus Gurib Fakim is a former president of Mauritius and head of mission of the African Union Poll Observer Mission. She spoke with me from the Tunisian capital, Tunis. The leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, Social Democratic Front, or SDF, is expressing cautious optimism that the government will implement promises made at the just-concluded national dialogue. John Fru indeed says President Paul Biya failed to keep previous promises toward English-speaking Cameroon. His remarks follow the conclusion of a national dialogue aimed at ending the country's conflict in the Anglophone parts of the country. Critics say the dialogue is unlikely to persuade the separatists to lay down their weapons as part of an effort to resolve the conflict. My main opposition leader, John Fru, indeed tells me fully implementing recommendations at the dialogue will be a key first step to resolving the crisis.
I cannot give a very concrete impression until the resolutions arrived at are implemented. Because sometimes things come to Cameroon, they are so nice, they look on paper so nice, but when they go to implement them, they are not implemented. Finally, they have agreed that they will give the North and Southwest a special status. They will give the Anglophone educational system and the Anglophone legal system, so that you should have a school of law for the Anglophones and a school of magistracy, which will reflect all the Anglophone legal systems. And you know that the problem started off from the legal systems and the schools. So now that they've done this, I do believe that we're taking at least a step forward.
Well, but Mr. Frundi, some are saying the suggestions that the government wants to put across is mere cosmetic, and that it doesn't address the full demands by Anglophones, and that there was preconditions of the fact that Anglophones going to establish their own country is non-negotiable. What is your take on that?
Now, they went to the law and found out that Articles 62.2 gives provision where they could give special status to the Anglophone section of the country. And this is what they agreed that they would implement. As I said, saying it is one thing and implementing it in a way that will calm down the situation is another thing. But so far, what I listened was to an extent, in a way, acceptable. Let us see how this will be implemented.
What about the demands for federalism or a return to how the country was? Was that considered?
Yeah, but you see, we have to start from by one step. As I said, already the Article 62.2 grants special status to the Anglophone region, where the contents of it, if they are well explained, you see that that is a step to federalism. And if these things are implemented honestly by Mr. Biya, which all of us are on the watch out, that would be a step to federalism.
There has also been demands that leaders of the so-called Ambazonians should be released unconditionally as part of a goodwill gesture. What did the government say about their demand for their immediate release?
Yeah, the SDF asked for the unconditional release of the people arrested, because we cannot be talking dialogue and reconciliation without him giving in something. And yesterday he did this. We are first waiting to see the people that is ordering to be released before we talk. So, because up to now, you don't know who is being released and who will still be in.
What are the expectations of the SDF following the conclusion of this national dialogue?
I do hope that the implementation phase of it will come up to let us have something out of the whole show. But for now, I say this hesitating because sometimes Mr. Biya does not come up to tell you that good morning, and sometimes good morning is the morning. So I do hope that Mr. Biya, at this stage, seeing the number of children that have died in the Anglophone, this thing, the economy that is broken down, which has affected all Cameroonians, he'll have that call of conscience to start implementing this, so that from there we'll see the loopholes and continue pushing for more. And if he had to do what is done now, it's because in the last National Executive Committee meeting of the SDF, we made it abundantly clear that if he does not resolve the Anglophone issue, we are not going to go back to Parliament, nor to Senate, nor will we take part in any election.
John Fruindi is the leader of the Cameroonian main opposition party, Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Meanwhile, hundreds of prisoners, including Cameroonian opposition leader Maurice Kamto, who claims he won the October 2018 presidential election and that his victory was stolen, are regaining freedom after President Paul Biya ordered the discontinuance of court proceedings against them. The president signed a decision Friday saying he is applying a resolution made during a national dialogue that was held in Yaoundé. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Hundreds of supporters sing and shout at the Yaoundé military tribunal that opposition leader Maurice Kamto, who has gained freedom, is the elected president of Cameroon and his victory was stolen. He and some members of his party were released from detention Saturday. Among them is 25-year-old Sebastian Gumfoy, who was arrested with hundreds of other people last Friday in Douala for protesting what they called Kamto's stolen election victory on October 7, 2018.
I was arrested on the 28th of February. I've been in cell, gendarme in Yaoundé for 7 months. So this is my first time in court, and God Almighty have been liberated. I plead that they should continue to do more. We face a lot of difficulties.
On Friday night, at the national dialogue called for by Biya to solve the country's crisis, especially the separatist war that has killed 2,000 people, the president ordered an end to court proceedings against some members of the Cameroon Renaissance Movement, CRM Party of Kamto. Sosten Medad Lipot, Kamto's spokesperson, says they will still continue pressing for Kamto to be officially declared the winner and recognized as president. Lippot says the president of Cameroon should have ordered the justice system that he manipulates to hasten Kamto's judgment. He says they wanted to prove the military tribunal that charged Kamto with insurrection for fighting over what they say is his stolen victory were using fabrications by the Biya regime. Kamto and about 500 of his CRM members were arrested after taking part in peaceful protests against alleged irregularities in the voting process that Biya easily won to claim a seventh term. Official results said Kamto finished a distant second with 14% of the vote. Amos Oum, a municipal councillor who took part in the national dialogue, says one of the strong recommendations made was that Biya should release all prisoners arrested in connection with the separatist war that has killed more than 2,000 in Cameroon's English-speaking regions, as well as people arrested for protesting the poll results.
Dans notre commission, la première recommandation que nous avons faite, c'était que le président de la République.
Oum says he is very happy that shortly after the president received the report, he ordered the release of the political prisoners, an indication that Biya also wants to restore peace. Biya this week also pardoned 333 separatist fighters accused of misdemeanors, but separatist leaders, including Julius Ayuk Tabe, who were sentenced to life in prison by a military tribunal in August, have not been released as requested by some at the National Dialogue. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zambia main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, says the ongoing constitutional review process is an attempt by the government to suppress dissent. The opposition party also says the process forms part of the effort for President Edgar Lungu to consolidate power as well as restrict the ability of parliamentarians to censure him and his governing Patriotic Front Party. For reaction, Sunday Chanda, the media director for the Zambian governing Patriotic Front Party, stopped by the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C.
Parliament is the only body that is competent enough to refine, to amend the law. And that is the position of the party, that we remain highly committed to ensure that our constitution speaks to the changing times, that we read our constitution of the lacunas that have come to the fore, and that we can agree that this is a document that is beyond any partisan interests. At the end of the day, it's about Zambia.
Talking about partisan interest, the UPND, particularly Hakainde Hichilema, leader of the United Party for National Development, or UPND, have been expressing concern about the way the review process is ongoing. Will their views be taken into consideration before a decision is made to refine or amend the constitution as you have it?
Unfortunately, we have an opposition that still feels that they didn't lose an election in 2016, and as a result, subconsciously, he thinks there's no president in Zambia, and we think that that is his greatest downfall. As it is, when the National Forum looking at the constitution sat, we had 16 members of parliament from the UPND attending that forum, participating in these processes. They went against his word. His word to his members of parliament was to shun this particular platform and not to participate in this process. Clearly, we're talking about an opposition leader who's losing grip within his political party, and people realizing that they don't exist to serve his personal interests. The members of parliament from the UPND understand that this is a matter of it's a matter of national interest, and as elected representatives of the people, they have a duty to do what is required of them to do as legislators, and that is to make the law. So we have Mr. Hakainde Hichilema playing politics at every turn. He'll play politics with climate change. He'll play politics with everything that comes to the fore. And we understand the levels of desperation. We're going into elections in 2021. He feels that if he could run ride on the back of misfortune. If this process could flop, then that works good for the UPND and it works against the Patriotic Front. But what he doesn't realize is that some of these things that he's been doing have come to haunt him.
One of the laws that a lot of Zambians have expressed concern about is the law that says you cannot abuse or insult the president. They said it was inherited from the colonizers, and as such, it violates the constitution itself, which guarantees press freedom or freedom of expression. Will that be looking at? Because I heard supporters of NDC saying that it is this law that is being used by the government, particularly President Edgar Lungu, to stifle dissent or to go after Chishimba Kambwili, a former cabinet minister and a Patriotic Front, is it a founding member?
Well, I think we must be agreed that the presidency is an institution and a creature of the constitution. That's number one. Number two, not everything that was inherited from colonizers is bad. We retain some of the provisions that we deem to be good, and we read of constitution those pieces of legislation we feel do not fit into the current dispensation. And so not everything, I mean, is bad about what was inherited from the colonial masters. I would give an example of the Public Order Act. There's no country on the face of the earth that has no Public Order Act. But again, that is a piece of legislation inherited from our colonial masters. Now, what the president has done and what the Patriotic Front has been pushing for is that even on the most contentious pieces of legislation, such as the Public Order Act, such as the Penal Code, the question has been, let the members of parliament, let the legislature do what they're supposed to do, and that is to amend the law.
Sunday Chanda is the media director for the Zambian Governing Patriotic Front Party. He spoke with me from here in Washington. A global education fund is providing tens of thousands of Sahelian children in crisis with a quality education. It seeks to bring hope to boys and girls who have known nothing but violence and sorrow in their young lives. Education Cannot Wait, a funding mechanism set up at the World Humanitarian Summit in 2016, is helping more than 1.4 million children in emergencies go back to school. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
More than 75 million children caught in conflict, natural disasters, and other emergencies are being deprived of an education. Children in the Sahel, a region just south of the Sahara Desert, are among the most vulnerable. In central Mali, armed conflict has forced the closure of more than 900 schools, depriving an estimated 280,000 children of an education. The director of Education Cannot Wait, Yasmin Sherif, recently returned from a mission to Mali. She describes the heart-wrenching condition of children she met in a camp for displaced people in the city of Mopti. She tells VOA of the psychological distress suffered by children forced to flee for their lives with nothing but the clothes on their backs.
They have fled some horrifying violence in the north. I spoke to several of them, young girls who saw their homes, their huts being burned down, fleeing from villages where summer executions took place. They are very traumatized, very traumatized.
Despite their frightful experiences, Sherif says the children arrive with their dreams of a better life intact. She says the young people have dreams of becoming doctors and lawyers and school teachers. She says education can turn these dreams into reality. She notes the crisis afflicting Mali permeates the Sahel region as a whole and is keeping 2.4 million children out of school. She says the fund has made recent emergency investments of $6 million in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger to support education for 187,000 children. She adds there are plans to scale up this aid and extend it to other Sahelian countries. While the Education Fund provides the money for projects, they are implemented by partners such as the UN Children's Fund and Save the Children. Sherif says impoverished, conflict-ridden governments welcome their support.
What they are receiving through our investments right now, through our partners on the ground, is rehabilitation of classrooms, learning spaces, latrines, distribution of learning materials, hygiene promotion, psychosocial support, teacher training, and mobilization of community members to help create the protective environments.
Education Cannot Wait is supporting programs in 32 countries, including Afghanistan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Syria, and Ukraine. The agency is seeking to raise $1.8 billion by 2021 to reach 9 million children and youths living in crisis. Sharif says 60% of the money raised will be targeted toward girls' education because girls always are the ones left furthest behind. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, in 2015, most UN member states agreed to work together to achieve 17 Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, by 2030. They include no poverty, zero hunger, and quality education. However, many experts say achieving the goal of gender equality, especially in the economic sphere, can help unlock the others. 5 years on, progress in gender equality has been mixed. But a new UN initiative is giving women entrepreneurs in the field of e-commerce a much-needed boost. VOA's Adam Phillips has more from New York.
As anyone who's been to a bustling outdoor market or a small shareholder farm can tell you, it's often the women who work the hardest and are the most entrepreneurial when it comes to feeding their families and helping their children go to school. But in Africa, as elsewhere, a digital marketplace where goods are bought and sold online can generate far more revenue than a purely physical one. Candice Nkot-Bissek is a Cameroon-born program director at the UN Conference on Trade and Development, or UNCTAD.
Most of the traditional merchants, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa, will be stuck in the market from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. in the evening. But thanks to an online market, they were allowed, just by putting pictures of their product online and having the proper logistics system, to sell 20, 30 times more, make more money, and grow their business, create employment, take care of more people in their community with all the positive ripple effect that you could imagine.
Nkot-Bissek directs the E-Trade for Women Advocates initiative, in which five carefully chosen women super entrepreneurs from around the world were flown to New York to meet with policymakers and everyday women at the UN General Assembly. Their purpose was to raise awareness of the wealth that women in digital businesses can create in developing economies.
We have a woman that is running an e-commerce company specialized in pharmaceutical products in China. You also have a woman specializing in empowering women in the field of agriculture in Africa, leveraging digital economy as well. You have one who develops, create, and sell application. You have one who has created a platform that allows business to sell online without having to develop their own website. They are all very impact-driven and successful entrepreneurs facing gender-related challenges in their respective country and willing to make a change.
One key gender-related challenge faced by female entrepreneurs is the lack of funding by governments, banks, and private investors due to gender bias.
It's still perceived, even in the West, as a fairly male industry. So sometimes a woman with a very attractive business will struggle to find funding or opportunities.
These e-trade advocates are also eager to reach out directly to women with an entrepreneurial spark and mentor them. For example, over the next year, each advocate will offer master classes in entrepreneurship within their own regions. And while the focus of several of these e-trade advocates is on women who want to start digital businesses, some seek to help women make more effective use of the technology they already have, like mobile phones, for businesses they already run, like small shareholder farms. Until now, women farmers have used their phones mostly for conversation or to look up market prices for the food they've grown. Next month, Patricia Zundi-Yao from Ivory Coast will launch a digital company that empowers those women even more.
With the fund, they can borrow seeds, fertilizer. Before, we would just provide them information about the price, but it's not enough. So we try now to give them marketplace. It's something good because we have some results to scale and to reach more women.
As technology evolves, the world is changing. However, one thing does remain constant. Embracing the power of women and their entrepreneurial spirit and energy will help pave the way forward for everyone, both locally and globally. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impunga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin in Doha, Qatar, at the World Athletics Championships, where Lelisa Desisa added the world marathon gold to the silver he won in Moscow 6 years ago, as he and teammate Mosenet Geremey headed an Ethiopian 1-2 on the final day of the championships. Desisa clocked a season's best of 2 hours, 10 minutes and 40 seconds, with Geremey 4 seconds back. Bronze went to Kenya's Amos Kipruto, who finished in 2 hours, 10 minutes and 51 seconds, with Britain's Callum Hawkins clocking 2 hours, 10 minutes and 57 seconds to repeat his fourth placing from the 2017 World Championships Marathon in London. Desane Tedesi, Eritrea's 5-time World Half Marathon Champion, led the lead group for much of the second half of the race before dropping to 6th place. One place above him was South Africa's Stephen Makoka, who had also taken the responsibility for the lead for long periods. Dale Zayala of Paraguay, who had run a personal best of 2 hours, 10 minutes and 27 seconds only 2 weeks earlier in Buenos Aires, dropped out very soon after the halfway mark, one of 18 who failed to finish from the field of 73. And at the Rugby World Cup in Japan, world champions New Zealand stretched out to a comprehensive 62-point winning margin over Namibia, but only after the underdogs had held them up with a brave first-half display. With 35 minutes gone, Namibia, ranked 23rd in the world, were within 1 point of the 3-time winners. But the All Blacks were in clinical mode in the second half, finishing with 11 tries. New Zealand will top Pool B if they beat Italy next weekend. That would set up a quarter-final against the runners-up of Pool A, which is boiling down to a 3-way fight between Japan, Ireland and Scotland. France will play England to decide who tops Pool C on Saturday after they finally subdued a battling Tonga. France had a 17-point lead before being reeled in, then rallying before a late Tonga try set up a frantic final. Pool C winners will face the runners-up in Pool D in the last 8. Australia look the most likely to finish second in Pool D, while Wales will top the group if they can negotiate matches against Uruguay and Fiji. Meanwhile, Italy props Andrea Lavori and Nicola Quaglio have both been banned for 3 matches for a dangerous tackle in their 49-3 defeat by South Africa on Friday. Loviti was dismissed in the 42nd minute for his part in picking up the Springboks Duane Vermeulen and dropping him headfirst on the floor. Replacement prop Quaglio was cited for his involvement in the same tackle. The Springboks beat Italy 49-3 in their Pool B clash in Shizuoka on Friday, and the Italians played most of the second half with 14 men after English referee Wayne Barnes showed Lavotti a red card. Finally, in football, visiting Harambe Starlets of Kenya left Accra Sports Stadium the happier side as they held the Black Queens of Ghana to a goalless draw on Friday in a third-round first leg of the 2020 Olympics qualifiers. The return leg is on Tuesday in Nairobi. Meanwhile, in Lusaka, Zambia beat Botswana 1-0, and Botswana will host the return leg on Tuesday. Cameroon moved a step closer to a spot at the next round of the continental qualifiers for the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Games after a 2-0 win over DR Congo, in the third round first leg on Thursday in Yaounde. Mayene Mayong and on form Ajara Chokwot scored in the first half, turned Cameroon a first leg cushioning ahead of the turn leg on Tuesday in Kinshasa. Elsewhere in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire and Nigeria played out to a barren draw in a keenly contested fixture. The Super Falcons, guided by standing coach Chris Danjuma, matched their host squarely as both teams shared the spoils. The return leg will take place on October 7th in Lagos, with the winner advancing to the next round of the Continental Qualifiers. Africa has one automatic slot to next year's finals in Tokyo, with the runner-up facing Chile in a playoff. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link you up again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
Otimbi na Kimbelio.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Inos B featuring Diamond Platinums with Yope. Then you have Rema coming up next with African Woman. Fuse ODG featuring Angel comes up next with Tina. And then Mara Andrade ends it up with Manga.
Wataka ule wewe, yope bapesa yo. Yope bapesa yo.
Les pacificateurs jusqu'au bout, Vital Kamene.
Biyuma no gagati, Tozoba no gagati. Biyuma no gagati, Tozoba no gagati. Oh Elka, initiative plus. Toza kolia, toza komela, to yena poga.
La haute dame Elga Elegance.
Yo pe bako daya.
Salomon Ben Salomon.
Awesome.
Mama Dangote. Don Mendes,
le président Obina Mungu, VIP Sons, Albert Mboyo, mon vieux.
Kukamkoka kera nyo mama akola kwa nyo alino kula bilira abato abato school fizo kusoma nebitabo olusi tebalina nalicho kuyo kuchifuna baguba ya titinka ya iya ibensula kone vyokulia omuchara Baguma Banigiriziwa Nebakola Independent woman African woman Oh Muchara Singa si Muchara Singa sa soma Singa Singa sa iga Singa si mamba we Singa sa kula Singa Sing a sing a hospital. Na Kuzomana Galua Baguma Bagitibu Bakola Beva Chara Singa 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 Mama nyikira nyo, nyo. She's so hard working and mankind. She's a woman of integrity. A mother, oh, Mushara. My mama, hey, mama, you must say, God, hey, Mushara.
My cheerleader, she's my diva. She hurt my head, oh mama. It's fused. She hurt my head, oh mama. Cupid, let's go. There ain't no rain on nobody. I just stop her loving her baby, oh yeah.
me old stories. Linus and Mandela and the truth behind Tripoli. Love the way she holds me when I'm down and lonely. Makes you feel all better. Telling me no, don't you worry. Since I came out the womb, mama gave me my womb. She be numero uno. I wanna hold her to know. Since I came out my mama womb.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The official visit of President Buhari of Nigeria to South Africa last week represents the kind of mature diplomacy that Africa needs. At the height of the xenophobic attack around Johannesburg, there were many who wondered whether this would rupture the cordial relations between South Africa and Nigeria. The fundamental of Nigeria's foreign policy is the recognition that Nigeria, as the country with the largest African population, has a responsibility to protect Africans everywhere in the continent. This is why in the long struggle against white minority rule in Southern Africa, the government of Nigeria and its people spared no efforts, time or resources to engage in the struggle. And that is why, even though Nigeria is located in West Africa, Nigeria was recognized as one of the frontline states. South Africa represents what has been called the Rainbow State, and it sets an example of how the African continent could cope with its diverse population who want to live in peace and tranquility. So the meeting between President Buhari and President Ramaphosa of South Africa was a timely one. It was aimed at promoting understanding, reconciliation, and to engage in rapprochement. And from all the reports that have come out, it seems it was a successful encounter. President Buhari, on the basis of those discussions, has given reassurances to those Nigerians still remaining in South Africa, encouraging them to stay and telling them that they will be protected. But there's more that could be done and should be done. In South Africa, there needs to be a major information campaign at the federal, provincial, and local level to educate the people of South Africa that Africans outside of the country mean no harm to South African people, that they have been joined in the struggle for their liberation, and that they should now try to reach out to those foreigners in their midst and not to turn against them because of their own problems of unemployment or other means. But also, one must understand that there could be rivalries between Nigeria and South Africa, which need not lead to being enemies. When South Africa gained its independence and apartheid, there were those who tried to push President Mandela to assume the leadership in Africa, and he refused. He said, "I will follow those who have been giving leadership to the African continent." Of course, later on, things changed under Mbeki. Also, when there was a discussion about his permanent seat in the Security Council, outsiders began to pick who should be. Some say it should be in Nigeria, others say it should be South Africa. this thing will go on. Nigeria itself was not so pleased when everyone was saying South Africa was at the largest economy. So it asked for a recalculation. And when those accounting recalculations were done, Nigeria emerged as the major economic power in the continent. So these things will go on, and they not need to be led to killing of each other. But as Nigeria and South Africa continue in their reconciliation and to promote understanding, both peoples of Nigeria and South Africa must know that there are bad actors around at the international, regional, and even local level that may not want to see rapprochement between Nigeria and South Africa. And they will exploit any evidence of xenophobic incidents to get into new serious dangers. For example, we saw what happened in Nigeria and South Africa. Nigerian shops, medium-sized and small-sized, were destroyed. But social media was saying that many were killed and implying many Nigerians were killed. That provoked some reaction in Nigeria. But the actual facts are 10 people were killed. Only 2 were foreigners. 8 were South Africans and none Nigeria. So people must be very wary of what they read in the social media, because bad actors can use the social media to spread news which will not help in the efforts of reconciliation. So let us hope that the meeting between President Buhari and Ramaphosa has set a beginning. We should be continuing to have reconciliation, exploring new ways or new avenues for reconciliation, because it is inconceivable that the peace trade agreement that has been signed in Africa can be successful if Nigeria and South Africa at each other's throats. So it is the interest of Africans all everywhere to encourage this reconciliation between Nigeria and South Africa. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the sun never sets without fresh news. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.